Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And I started to tell a little bit about the details. My father was actually taking a sofa cushion and put it on top of the telephone. He was not a person who was afraid of that many things. And he was just saying, just to be sure.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Stefan was born in Karl-Marx-Stadt and was conscripted into the NVA, the East German Army, in 1988. When he left school, he started an apprenticeship for electronics, learning how to build radio receivers at Rima, a then famous producer of hi-fi equipment. Stefan is called up at 18 for his 18-month service, and he talks of the conscription process and the incentives offered to him to serve for a longer period. He is posted to a unit in Leipzig, which was responsible for telephone lines from the NVA headquarters for the area south of Berlin. He describes the training he took and the role he carried out, including installing phones for NATO Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty inspectors. In the summer of 1989, many citizens of East Germany flee the country via the now semi-open Hungarian border, and Stefan describes heightened tension within the army. Don't miss next week's episode, where Stefan continues his story as the country falls apart and the Berlin Wall opens. The battle to preserve Cold War history is ongoing, and your support can provide me with the ammunition to continue to keep this podcast on the air. Via a simple monthly donation, you'll become one of our community and get a sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history.
Hi, this is Tree from Berlin. I believe it's so important and interesting to hear these stories from that period, good and bad. Books will tell you so much, but the real-life stories from people who were there make it so real.
If a monthly contribution is not your cup of tea, we also welcome one-off donations via coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Stefan to our Cold War conversation.
I was born in 1970 in Karl-Marx-Stadt, which is now called Chemnitz, but during the years it was Karl-Marx-Stadt after the famous philosopher. And I grew up having a probably typical East German childhood. I was the only child of my two parents, and they were doing regular jobs, so nothing fancy there.
It's just you and your parents in the family, yeah?
Exactly, yeah.
What job did they have in East Germany?
So my father is a mathematician, he worked in some institute not too closely affiliated with the state. And my mom was actually also in a production company. She did some secretary services and some calculations on the energy sector, stuff like that. Regular office jobs.
Neither of them were members of the party per se.
No, they were not. So my parents, actually also including me, they were not resistant or so, right? They were also not in the party. It was more like, I think, with most of the people in the GDR, just trying to get by. And my mom actually had her own little history of not being allowed to study because she did not do the Jugendweihe, which is the thing that you do with the, I think it comes out of a communist tradition, where instead of the church thing that you do with 14, they had some alternative thing. governed by the state. And because she didn't want to do that, she didn't want to do the Jugendweihe, she was not allowed to study. And that sort of maybe raised her resistance a little bit, but, you know, not like in a real way that she was doing forbidden things or so. It was more like on a private level, and similar from my dad. They were sort of neutral and trying to get around in life.
From my interviews that I've done, is that people are sort of expecting the Stasi at every corner and, you know, the ever oppressive state. But the vast majority of people were just getting on with their life as they could, in the same way that people were in the West, and just sort of accepted the way things were.
Sort of, right? I mean, that's, I think, probably one of the most frequent discussions when you get even nowadays that people still discuss. On one hand, it was sort of clear that there was always the possibility that somebody you're talking to might be with the Stasi or might be, you know, giving reports to the Stasi as an unofficial member. On the other hand, you just, you know, we were friends with people and you just couldn't think of them doing something like that. And as many, many people saw after the war came down, that was actually more frequent than we thought at GDR times. That was pretty surprising for me. Thankfully, I didn't have such thing. I did look up my Stasi files and I did not see anything that, you know, anybody did something, said something bad about me or so. It was very, very thin. But yeah, I know many other people who had bad surprises.
Did your family have any relations in the West at all or not?
Yes, actually, they did. Not very close. But I think the closest one was an aunt my mother had. And actually, she was able to visit her when her aunt turned 80, I believe, in 87. Also, from my father's side, we had some relatives, maybe not too close. And my parents actually also always made a point about not hiding that, right? So it was kind of a protection for not being asked to join the party or getting into jobs that, you know, were too close to the state. They always told me, you know, never hide that and make sure you mention that all the time so they cannot say you hid it and you did bad things.
And what was your school life like, Stefan?
So I did the regular 10 years of, you know, school education that everybody had, like a secondary school. And until I turned maybe 15 or so, I had no intention to do grammar school or A-levels. And I wanted to basically get an apprenticeship and, you know, get what I thought at this point, a real job. And I remember telling my parents, you know, I don't want to end up in a lab being in one of these white coats and doing theoretical things. I want to do some practical stuff. Yeah, but before that, school was sort of uneventful for me. I just got by and had some, you know, minor troubles, but nothing serious.
Did you play much sport or anything at school?
Not too much. I was into bicycling a little bit, and also a lot of electronics, which, you know, I later had my apprenticeship in and also studied later on. But that was more or less not involved with school. There were central places called Pioneer House, or again, organized by the state, where you could get together and, you know, do something about your hobby. I think I was there for maybe a year or two, but mostly it was not for me. I was more happy with doing this by myself and with a friend.
Was there any military training at your school?
Yes, there was actually. So I think in the age of 14, most male children had to go to, I think for a week or so, to this like pre-training, and where they already tried to convince you to do more than the usual 18 months of military service. That was, by the way, that was a topic all the time, right? Through your whole childhood in the GDR, it was always about joining the army and, you know, going for more than the 18 months. And I basically resisted that all the time because, you know, I couldn't see myself shooting other people. That was not the biggest thing, but at least, you know, part of the story for me. Also, physical activities, I mean, I did them, but I did not particularly enjoy them. And military was always about physical stuff all the time. So I just couldn't see myself there. I had a pretty clear vision of what I wanted to do in life. And military service just was a necessary evil that I had to do at one point. So actually in school, I managed to not having to do that. We were just too many boys in our class, so there was not enough space in getting to this 1 week of military education, and three of us had to stay home. And in the same week, the girls had, I think, some medical training, like, you know, first aid and stuff like that. And we were joining them, which was actually good fun. So it was a useful skill to have, more useful than, you know, knowing how to shoot. So I enjoyed that.
And you mentioned an apprenticeship. So where did you end up doing that, and what was the apprenticeship about?
Yeah, so I was into electronics a lot as a child, and I wanted to do that as my regular job. So with most people in the GR, if you weren't doing your A-levels and study, you would get an apprenticeship. That was, I don't know the percentage, but I think the vast majority was going that route. So you would have 10 years of school education and then 2 or 3 years of apprenticeship, and then you would just start your regular job life. And for me, there weren't too many companies around us offering apprenticeships for what I wanted to do. And my marks in school were not that great. So I was between 2 and 3 all the time, and which was, you know, 1 the best and 5 the worst. And these apprenticeships for electronics and, you know, radio mechanic and all that kind of stuff, they were sought after a lot. So I did not see myself having high chances. So when I was looking around, there were basically 2 places that were sort of indicating before that when I visited them together with my dad. They were saying, yeah, you know, we could see you here. There are others with better marks, but, you know, maybe it works out. So you had to put in some papers. And so I applied actually at 2 places. And the second place, which was my favorite, was Rema Stolberg. That's actually, I would say, in the GDR, pretty famous producer of radios, radio receivers. And they didn't take me, right? They said, we found somebody who has some worse marks than you, but is willing to do 25 years of military service, so we can fulfill our quota, and sorry, not for you. So I was going back to that other place, and they were actually saying, you know, you can get in, right? So I was in that other place, and funny enough, they didn't do the education themselves, so they sent me to that other place, to Rema Stolberg. They had wide eyes when they saw me on day one. Before that, they said, you know, you can't come. And then I was going in through that other company, sending me over there for my apprenticeship. So I ended up in the place where I wanted to go, but with some detour, so to say.
Raymar were making hi-fi equipment,
yes,
as well, weren't they?
True, yeah.
So was it a very popular brand in East Germany for electronics, radios, and hi-fi?
It's hard for me to say, like, you know, absolutely, because many products in the GDR were always rare, right? Not because of their quality, because everything was, maybe except cabbage, everything was rare, right? And I think, you know, from learning a little bit about them, and also from what I heard from others, from friends or so, you know, do you get access to some of these radios? Can you buy one for me and such? The image these radios had, especially maybe in the 60s and 70s, were very, very good. So people were liking them a lot. And I had this funny story. As part of my apprenticeship, you had to basically rotate a couple of basically places for doing different things in that company. So part of that was, I think, maybe 6 weeks or even 2 months of being in the research and development department. And until that, I had seen other parts of that company and doing some work on the production line and other places. And there was this one radio everybody was speaking the highest of, you know, this is like the best of what we can do. And everybody was proud of that thing. And when I came to that research department, you know, you had your regular coffee conversations with people, and I was talking to two of the engineers over there, and I was saying, you know, I'm so in love with this particular radio, and such a good thing, and the quality is so good. And they were just looking at me saying, that's a design of the Western company Grundig from 1972. Right. So that was 15 years old. That was the highest and the best that the GDR could produce. And that's 15 years after what West Germany was producing. So that was quite devastating for me at this time.
So were they copying West German designs?
That's hard to say for me. I have no definitive information about this. I would suspect so, because there was many, transistors and chips and such were being copied. At the same time, there was also quite some engineering going on that clearly was not copied, and also basically general ingenuity of people. So maybe parts of that, but I can't really tell for sure.
At what age do you get called up into the East German Army?
Between 18, which was like the earliest they could call you, and I think 25 was the latest they could call you. So there were very rare cases of people becoming 26 and not having been called before that, and you were basically free then. And yeah, actually, that was one of the main fears I had when planning my job. Then after the apprenticeship, I was thinking, what do I do after exiting the apprenticeship, and what would my life look like? And actually, during the apprenticeship, I developed some more appreciation for what before that I called being in the lab in a white coat, and I didn't want to do that. Actually, I found out that the more interesting jobs, at least more interesting to me, were actually those exclusively of people who went to study. So I developed that idea. Maybe that's for me. And then I found out that the GDR had this sort of, it was not a written down rule, but practically it was like that. You were basically not allowed to study before actually serving the army. I think it was kind of an unwritten rule. So I was actually fearing, while still being an apprentice, I was fearing, it could be that I'm 25 and they would call me for 18 months. So when I'm exiting, I'm 27, and starting studies at 27 was like, that looked too late for me. I was unsure about that thing, and I was offered an escape then that I actually took.
So what age were you when you got your notice?
I think shortly before my 18th birthday. And that was pretty normal. You would get this call to where to go and such. And I was getting this invitation for muster in somewhere in spring in 88. And that was around the time when I had made up my mind that I actually want to study. There was this like commission of people. I sort of knew from other people how this is going to go, right? There's the medical part where they sort of inspect you and test you and all of that. And then there was the final part, which was like the final attempt to convince you of doing more than your 18 months.
What incentives did they give you to convince you to do more than 18 months?
Yeah, funny enough, that was the first time that somebody ever offered me something concrete. Until then, it had always been like, you got to do it for the socialism, and everybody, who's going to, value themselves, they do something more, and society paid for all your education, and now you get to give something back. It was always about this, like, glorious way of us together. We're building the socialism and all of that. And there was never any discussion about, any advantages you would have or any, perks you would get from doing longer than that. And that was the first time when I went in, and they didn't even ask, right? They were just looking into their papers saying, okay, we see you have this, you're close to finalizing your apprenticeship. This is a sort after thing. Have you considered doing more than your 18 months? And I said, yeah, consider it, but it's not really for me, and I have plans. Maybe that was my mistake to say that I wanted to study. And that's when one of these people, I can't remember one of the three maybe or so, basically said like, oh, you want to study, so, you know, how are you going to do that? Because, you know, it could be a long time until, you know, you get to serve the army and then you can study. And I was saying, yeah, not sure, that's a problem. And then they started offering me saying, okay, so maybe if you could consider doing 3 years instead of 18 months, we could offer you, I think it was basically three things. They offered me to call me right away in autumn. So in the same year, basically 6 months after these talks, they offered me to place me somewhere relatively near my hometown, which was another problem for many of the conscripts. You could end up somewhere, you know, near the Baltic Sea or in the middle of Brandenburg or some place where it takes you a long, long time to get home, where there's no other life than your barracks. And, you know, these 18 months would be like a boring time at best, maybe even worse. And the third they offered me, which was actually the most intriguing for me, they offered to put me into something where I could make use of my skills as an electronics worker, so to say. This is the answer to all of my troubles, right? I would get to do these three years. Yeah, it's double the time, of course, but I would get to do them maybe in an easier way than 18 months in the middle of nowhere. I would get to continue doing what I enjoyed, and that was electronics, and not being too far away from home actually was also nice. So I actually, something that I never did again, I decided on the spot on this day when they called me in that I want to do this, and I actually signed. And my parents were shocked, right? They were saying like, how could you do that? How could you do that? Like, yesterday you were sure that, you know, it's 18 months and nothing else, and you had your plans and all of that, and today you're coming back saying you're doing 3 years. And it was not like signing with the devil, but it was seriously something they had their eyes wide open, you know, in disbelief. So I remember that very well.
But did they understand that, you know, you were seeing this as a learning opportunity and coming out with some better qualifications?
I think after discussing it and, you know, explaining them my reasoning and all of that, they understood. But I also remember my dad actually telling me something that I obviously, like, you know, did not forget, because it was so obvious that I thought, you know, why didn't I think of that? He was saying, okay, you signed some paper for doing 3 years. What paper did you get from them? Right? You got promises. Like, you know, in talking, do you have anything in writing? And I thought, oh no, he's right. Right? They fooled me. I will end up somewhere totally different in some totally different environment, and, you know, maybe as a tank commander or so. And that was actually pretty much horror for me to think like, you know, they fooled me. But actually to take that look at in advance. All of that became true, right? I mean, that was not often that people kept their promises, like, officially in the GDR, but they kept all of their promises. That was surprising, actually. So I trusted, sort of, that was my only way out, right? I had signed, and I trusted, okay, somehow this will work out, and it did work out. So that was, even then, surprising.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
So did you still have to do the same training that every NVA soldier did, or did this role mean that you could skip that?
I think for me, it was quite different for many reasons. So no, I did not have to do all of the training. The regular career path for what I was called in for, like doing 3 years, you were considered a non-commissioned officer, you know, for a limited time. And usually everybody had to go through 6 months of pretty harsh training where you had like all of the physical things, and you also had to, you know, like your whatever you're specializing in. Like for me, it would have been electronics, and for others, it would have been, I don't know, like, you know, how to drive a tank or whatever else. And but there were two things that helped me here. First of all, in this year in 88, they made a change in the calendar when they were calling in the conscripts. They changed it to September and March. And so I think in 89 was the last time they called in people in March. And the good thing for me was, it seems like nobody was prepared for that, right? They were all, the place I ended up in, they were all so scheduled for November and May. Getting these few people in September was apparently a big surprise, and they didn't plan a lot for us. So I had to do a 6-week basic education. I was told later pretty relaxed. So I think I did the obstacle course maybe once or twice, and I never had to stand guard and you know, all of the regular stuff. I just didn't have to do it because of schedule things, and then of course also because of the role they had planned for me to be in the, what I had to do there.
But you still had basic weapons training, I'm presuming.
Yes, we had that, but I tried to count at one point. It must have been less than 20 or so shots I ever fired in my life. So ammunition was always short, and nobody was eager to do more than necessary. And for me, it was after the basic training. I think I did once or twice again a repetition of that, but that was it. So wasn't a big deal.
And what were your fellow comrades' backgrounds in the unit? You know, where had they come from?
So it was basically a signal battalion, and that signal battalion was associated to the sort of high command for everything south of Berlin. So we were maintaining the phone lines and the phone system and telegraphs and all of that. That battalion was sort of split into half. Half people working in the open and half people working in encryption services. And these encryption services, that was a crazy world. So they, you know, we were like living in the barracks together, with sort of a separation, but not too much. And then in the morning, when you went into the place where you did your work, they were basically going beyond another like iron door, and nobody was even allowed to have a look into all of that. And so there was lots of secrecy around that. Later on, I heard that they had, you know, very strict regimes about all of that encryption stuff and key exchange and all of that. So that was the first time I was ever in touch with that. But I was in the open part, so I actually did not get to see much of that, only after the wall came down and most of that was opened. But there was a lot of secrecy. So whenever you had, like, you know, people sitting together and drinking beer or so, there was one point where the conversation stopped. People were saying, yeah, we cannot talk about this, right? And that was strange, because normally if you're in a private setting, there wasn't that much that couldn't be talked about. But this one was always a strange thing. So I don't know that much about the background of these people. I think they were checked much more thoroughly than people like me or my friends. That was a crazy sort of divide that we had.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what sort of checks they did on you before you had this role. Did they do any form of background check on you that you're aware of? Did your Stasi file show any of that?
The Stasi files did not show anything, and I did not have to hand in any special things. So I would have expected they asked me, I don't know, to write down, you know, letter laying out my relatives in West Germany or whatever else. But maybe they knew about this already, right? And that was one thing. But The only two things that were kind of strange and happening was a couple of weeks after I had signed up for the 3 years of service, my parents, who like most of the people in the GDR, had an application out for getting a telephone, which was not a normal thing, right? You just couldn't just get a telephone in the GDR. Maybe, I don't know, one in 20 people or one in 50 or so had a phone at home. But everybody had an application in because, you know, sometimes maybe you get one. And then suddenly, a couple of weeks after I had signed up, my parents were getting this phone and we were like, what is that? And I didn't make the connection back then. My parents, they told me later, they made that connection. I never saw anything that would confirm that this was the reason, but that was the first thing I saw, you know, maybe there's a relation here. And I remember even when I think it was the first time, it was still GDR time when I came back from the army for vacation, and I started to tell a little bit about the details. My father was actually taking a sofa cushion and put it on top of the telephone. he was not a person who was afraid of that many things. But at this point, I was looking at him, what are you doing? And he was just saying, just to be sure.
An interesting connection there. It makes you wonder whether they perhaps wanted to have some way of listening in on your calls just to see what contacts there were going on with the West. I don't know. It's an interesting one.
It's probably something we'll never know, right? Because like you said, the Stasi file, I looked this up and either it was destroyed, but I'm sure I wasn't important enough that somebody was actively trying to destroy anything about me in 89. And then the other thing that happened was also after the wall fell down, a fellow family who was living with us in the same, you know, we were living in one of these Neubau blocks, or, you know, we had six stories, but there was some with 11 or even 20 stories. And we were living in those with six stories and 12 families in that house. And for every house, there had to be kept what they call the house book or some kind of registry. When you had visitors, they had to sign in. I don't think we ever did that when we had visitors, but at least it was officially required. And after the war came down, that family who was running this registration within our house, they came to my parents saying, you know, just before, I think they said summer 88 or something like that. So it must have been shortly before I was called in. There were these strange people and asking things about Stefan and, you know, things about you. And so apparently the Stasi did some checks. I don't know. It's in relation to my service there. Again, I didn't find anything in my files. Actually, now that we're talking, I think my parents were checking their files as well, and they did not have anything either. So either way, it's, I don't know.
You were potentially in quite a sensitive role here because you're working on the communications for a major command post of the East German Army. For me, I guess it wouldn't be surprising that they did do some further checks on you.
It's possible.
Did you ever get access to your East German Army file after the fall of the wall? Was that ever possible for you to see that or not?
Maybe I was naive at this time, but I didn't even think that there was a file about me, right? I mean, obviously they must have something like, you know, what's his name and what's his
home address. They've got that piece of paper you signed, Stefan. That's all it was.
Yeah. But I didn't even try. Actually, that's a good question. Maybe I should try if there is something about me.
Yeah, I don't know whether you can get access to it. Probably, I'd just be fascinated to see whether there's any other mention of, you know, anything else in there. I don't know. So with your role, I mean, what is the day-to-day job like? What are you doing day-to-day?
So we were a group of five people in with similar background than I had. Everybody was doing their 3 years and had a plan to study within, you know, the immediate group that I was working in. Our responsibility was basically the phone system itself, at least partially. We had a civil employee that was doing most of the work. He was way more qualified to do that than we were, like, with, you know, our apprenticeship and being 18 or 19. So he did most of the work, but all of the, like, you know, maintenance of going to some of these offices of the generals or, you know, the high officers when the phone is broken or when some of their stuff wasn't working well. We had to go there and exchange either the phone or repair it in place or whatever was necessary. And then there were also these like central systems where, you know, all the cables were coming in and being routed to whatever place within the barracks and all of that. So maintaining that was a large part of our job. And this was like a 24-hour job. So you had to be not only in the barracks, but also at your desk, so to say, for 24 hours. And then there were 2 days of being off, and then again, 24 hours. That was kind of a regular scheme. And it wasn't always like that, but most times were like that. And you could actually normally sleep during the night, so it wasn't that bad. But you had to be on the watch always, right, if there was something going on. And it could be some general at home finding out that his phone wasn't working and we had to go out. That was very rare, but it happened because the phones in their private homes were also maintained and owned by the NVA. And so we had to go there as well. But it happened very rarely. But it was possible that this was necessary, and therefore we had to be available at all times. One person had to be available at all times. And that was basically divided between the five of us. So there was somebody like me coming in, you know, needed to be onboarded and educated and all of that. And somebody were always on the way out because they were close to their 3 years and making sure they leave all of the knowledge there. So that was kind of what was split between the five of us.
I seem to remember reading somewhere that some of the East German phone system was still the same infrastructure from sort of like the Nazi era. I mean, was it an old infrastructure in East Germany?
Actually, two friends of mine, I'm still friends with two of the five people. Both of them were doing their apprenticeship with Deutsche Post, which was the kind of service provider of a phone and letter services and all of that. And they have a much better picture. And what they told me, and what seems to be in line with what I also read at these times, is that most of the public infrastructure, like what Deutsche Post had, was indeed very, very old, mostly mechanical stuff that you had some relays and stuff that was really, you know, like maybe not World War II, but you know, not much newer. But the funny thing was that the NVA had pretty modern stuff for GDR standards. So, for instance, the phone exchange that we were running, it was, you know, I mean, you would laugh nowadays, but it was from the 60s, so it was only 20 years old when I came there. So that was relatively young. And then we also had some of the systems for basically multiplying or multiplexing phone calls onto regular lines like PCM and other stuff. That was maybe from the mid-80s or so, maybe 3 years old or 5 years old. Again, all, you know, on the level of what GDR did do. So for GDR standards, that was pretty up-to-date. So that was not bad. So you couldn't, you probably would have to be with Stasi or some research lab or so if you wanted to work on newer stuff within the GDR. But that was all right. That was good fun.
Were you made aware of the Allied military liaison missions in East Germany and to watch out for them snooping around?
Not directly. So it was not part of the education. So we didn't know anything about I mean, of course, everybody knew that the Russians could do what they wanted, right? But nobody told us that actually the French and the British and the US could actually also get around and do something. But I was involved with that kind of stuff once, which I remember also very lively because it was a big event for me at this point. There was a secret code word that if you were on these 24 hours thing on this rotation, you always had to have a backup who didn't have to be with you like physically, but the backup had to be within the barracks and be available within like 20 minutes or whatever that was. And one of the roles of that backup was, of course, you know, if you fell ill during your duties to back you up, like it was said. But the other role was, and actually I had to do this then once, the other role was when the secret code word was coming in via phone. It was like in a spy movie, right? You were getting called and can't remember what the code word was, but something like rocket inspection, which turned out to be, you know, funny enough, close to what was actually happening. And then you would have to call your backup. And at this, when this happened in, I think it was in early 89, when this happened, I was actually the one that was the backup and I was called in. So I was giving a driver who would drive me together with a phone, some of these funny GDR phones, into one of the hotels in downtown Leipzig. There was this driver, actually, I think he even had a weapon with him. I can't remember exactly. And I was sitting next to him in a Trabant with that phone, with that orange phone on my knees. And our mission was to go to that Inter Hotel and install the army phone in one of the bedrooms. What turned out then, I was told later on, all of that was about, is exactly for the Allies, and I think for some international inspection program, there was a foreign, I can't remember, some inspector was arriving in Leipzig with the mission to do some of these rocket inspection thing, like, you know, how many SS-20 or whatever the Russians had in the GDR was inspecting that. And for him or her staying overnight, there had to be one of these phone lines to be available. And of course, you know, all of the hotels in GDR time didn't have a direct connection to the NVA phone system. And the purpose of me was actually going there, installing that phone, testing it and making sure it works, and then of course get out again. And that was a funny thing. So first you get to leave the barracks, which was not something you could do every day, and then the second one was like, you know, it was awkward walking into this this fancy hotel with, you know, beautiful people all around you, and you would be there in your army dress and with this crazy phone under my arms and getting into these rooms. And that, like I said, it was like a spy movie, right? I went to the desk and saying like, Raketeninspektion. What? Oh, sorry, hold on for a moment. Then they were looking up. Apparently they were inspected too, and they knew what to do. That was fun.
Yeah, it sounds like these could have been people who were checking on the INF, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, that had been signed a few years before. And it was part of those inspection teams. So as sort of 88 moves into 89, are you sensing that East Germany is changing or there's any tensions out there?
I think I was pretty late in realizing there was something going on. I think the earliest I really understood there was something going on was maybe in summer 89. You saw this, you know, in TV that people were fleeing GDR through Hungary and such. But that was not seen as, at least I didn't see this as a big turnaround. It was, it was sort of an escalation and something that hasn't happened in that, at least not with that many people before. But I think I first realized there was something strange going on when, so I said before, we were not allowed to leave the barracks every day because we were only serving these 3 years and we were treated more like conscripts than you know, real officers or sergeants or whatever. And then suddenly there was this sort of order saying on Mondays, you cannot go out at all anymore. You had to apply, you had to get one of these tiny tickets in order to leave the barracks. And there was this order saying, no, on Monday, it's not possible anymore. And okay, why that? I didn't understand it. And then somebody was telling me, yes, of course, it's because of demonstrations. And I said, what? And then I started looking a little bit closer and, you know, talking to others. And it turned out, you know, there was what then turned into these Monday demonstrations in Leipzig. That was the reason they had become so big that they feared any of us taking part. That would have been crazy. I would have never done that. I'm too risk averse probably. But again, also like, you know, not having any interactions by chance by somebody just walking by, because it was deep in the city center, and part of leaving the barracks was always going for some food somewhere or having a beer or so. And that was naturally quite in the city center. And so it could have happened very easily that I would walk into some of these groups and then somebody taking photos or whatever would not have looked good.
So you had very little way of knowing what was going on outside. So being in the army, there was no way you could watch West German TV or listen to Western radio.
We found a way, but that was very high risk, right? So there was one TV for each, I don't know, maybe, 50 people or maybe even 30 people. And they were all sealed, with these plastic seals that you weren't able to change the channels at all. But then somebody, can't remember exactly how, got hold of one of these stems that you got. So we were actually able to change it and actually watch some Western television. But it was always something like there was always a ceremony about this, right? Somebody had to be literally on the watch trying to watch out for somebody walking in who was not clear of or not okay with watching Western television. So yes, we did that, but not on a regular basis and certainly not during that time. Because you could see the tension arising also within the NVA. Like all of the officers, most of them were pretty close to the state. I think it was basically not possible to be to get the next rank without being in the party. And I think that was pretty soon that maybe you could get promoted once or twice, and then after that, it was impossible to get promoted without being in the party. So most of them were like, we kept on saying these are the red people, or they have red ears, or whatever the slang was, and you could see the tension arising among them as well. I can't remember exactly whether we did not or did do this, but it was certainly not something like you did every night, like at home, right? I mean, my parents and me, we were watching almost exclusively West German television because the East German stuff was just unbearable. So, but we couldn't do that while in the barracks.
I'm intrigued to know what you chose to watch in the barracks.
There was just two possibilities. There was GDR1 and GDR2.
But what about the Western when you had somebody on watch to make sure you weren't interrupted? What Western TV did you choose to watch then?
I don't remember us watching as any of the, RTL or Sat.1 or whatever private companies were arising then. So it must have been the first and the second program, like ARD and ZDF, pretty sure that it was one of the two of them.
So were you watching like TV serials like Dallas?
I think the only thing I remember pretty lively is that we were watching the news, of course, for obvious reasons. But I was never much into movies, so I'm not sure if I would have even stayed instead of, reading a book or doing some of my hobby stuff or so. I was into photography at this time, and I was even allowed to bring a camera into the barracks, but all sealed, and then I have to give them into somebody else watching for it, and then when I left, I could take it and take it with me and all of that. It was okay for spending your time, but I can't remember watching like movies or so. Maybe, and surely others have done it, but it didn't. If I did it, it didn't impress me much.
So, did you take many photos during that period?
Not in 89. So I was again not I didn't have the guts to do that. So I stayed away from most of that. From September, maybe August even. I think it was even August in 89. We were not allowed to go out on Monday anymore. And because I had to hand in my camera again when I entered the barracks again, I was mostly making sure that I'm not getting into any trouble. And since, from my family and also from my other background, I was not one of these people in resistance. I had no intention to do anything like that. Most of my photos from that time were more like personal stuff. And, Leipzig Zoo or Zoo is pretty well known. I did take a lot of photos there and countryside and all of that. But nothing interesting from a historic perspective, so to say.
We're in that period when the demonstrations are going on, and I think you get called to do a certain job on the 7th of October 1989. Can you just take us through that?
Sorry, folks, you're just going to have to wait another week for the next episode where Stefan describes the end of East Germany and his induction into the Bundeswehr, the West German Army. Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.